Atlantic to the Pacific, from mountain crest to mountain crest, from the canyons to the clouds and into the cosmos, we are pumping wattage high and low, plus streaming worldwide on the internet and keeping you company tonight. It's the place to relax and hang out. I'm your host, Vance Pollock. This is Joshua P. Warren speaking of strange, giving you the latest and discussing the weirdest. We have assembled the finest team of reporters and most intriguing guests. We are the favorite program of hodags, wendigos, skunk apes, and donkey devils, so stay tuned. This hour, bearing down on Zelda Fitzgerald, the woman, the myth, the reinvention in the 21st century. And Jim McKenzie, he has a certain fondness, a certain knack for Asheville local literary celebrities. You have a sort of passion or appreciation for those folks, don't you?
I would say so. I think it's fascinating to live in a town with so much literary history, and then the more I look into it, the more there is here. And then we have such big names associated with our town, like F. Scott and Zelda and Thomas Wolfe. I mean, they were, iconic in their time and probably still are today. So
I think what's timely for our conversation tonight about Zelda Fitzgerald, of course, the wife of F. Scott Fitzgerald, perhaps most widely remembered for his novel, The Great Gatsby. Is that considered a novel or is it a novella? It's kind of a short one, but I don't know how you differentiate between a novel and a novella.
Yeah, I'd say it's a novel, but you know, in F. Scott's time, he wrote one bestseller and then did not write. You know, Great Gatsby wasn't a big seller, so by the time Great Gatsby came out, people were saying he was washed up. It wasn't until World War II and the paperback novel and mass distribution of books like that people, and then now he's in every English, you know, high school English canon. So he kind of lived in obscurity the last 15, 20 years of his life.
How many years was he in Asheville?
Zelda was here off and on for 12 years. So he would have been from about the mid, he probably would have been here 4 or 5 years because he died in 1940.
Okay.
And she started coming here in the mid to late 30s. So he probably would have been here on and off 4 or 5 years.
He did come to visit her here frequently.
Sure.
And even take up residence, like we mentioned, at the Grove Park Inn.
Oh, yeah. And there's some, there's a good book by, I think the guy's name is Tony Butita. And he knew F. Scott in Asheville during that time. The book is called, like, The Good Gay Times, I think.
Right.
And it's a chronicle of his times with F. Scott. And F. Scott, even without Zelda, was a steamrolling, heavy drinking, getting tossed out onto the streets kind of a guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like it didn't end with her.
And Zelda is the title role in a new Amazon series, Z: The Beginning of Everything, and also coming up March 10th. Was a tragic day in Asheville history, a tragic night. Actually, some of the fatalities, the death certificates read variably March 10th or March 11th. So the fire must have gone on right through the middle of the night, March 10th, March 11th, 1948. We're talking about the Highland Hospital fire and. Can you give us a little background on Highland Hospital and what it was? Because a lot of people, to read some of the circumstances, maybe some rumor associated with the Highland Hospital and the fire, you would think that it was a place where people were just cast aside, people that had no recourse. But first of all, what I wanted to point about Highland Hospital is that there were many well-to-do, wealthy, well-off people at Highland Hospital. What were they seeking treatment for?
Sure. So this was back in the day. The doctor, Robert Carroll, he was kind of I think he was trained at Duke University, I think, but he had a controversial opinions that he thought that if you had some type of mental illness, you could graduate up the rungs through the hospital and one day serve on this, you know, and work there and be a caretaker and et cetera, and that gave a lot of the people there something to work toward, but it also might have caused the demise of the hospital. I kind of tend to believe the rumor. Just because the hospital was never proven to be an arson, it doesn't mean it wasn't. I think there were too many coincidences around the arson. And I'm going to call it an arson. I think it was an arson. I think it was an intentionally set fire.
And you're referring to one version of the story that has a patient at the hospital who has been granted, you know, some access, you know, for good behavior, for, you know, has earned some privileges around the hospital. Does that version of the story suggest that they even went around locking doors, locking people in?
Yes.
And setting curtains on fire and linens or?
I think that probably the fire might have been started in one spot.
Right.
I think. But yeah, her name was Willie, and it seems to be that she had tried to set the place on fire several times. And every time, like, there was a fire in the kitchen and under the stairs, and every time the fire was discovered and put out. But that also means that you're not well, you know, you're trying to set fire to the place where you're living. That was should have been a red flag. So the night it happened, the patients, I think 10 of them were sedated, and 9 of them died. So one of them did get out, and they were all locked in their rooms. Something that was that I think Willie would have overseen, and the place was set on fire, and gruesome death. I mean, the only thing that identified Zelda was her slipper. Like there was a foot in the slipper, and I think that's how they identified her body because it was beyond charred.
And you say in the scene, the opening of the new Amazon series, it shows the slipper in
that's
the...
That's how it kicks off, and it shows a little pink slipper. Now, I don't know if that's... Knowing the history, I don't know if they mean that to be that slipper or if being a director, you know, everything has some... You know, symbolism deeper. I don't know if they're trying to show that she was once a ballet dancer. I don't know, but that is true. They show a pink slipper in a charred, burnt out hospital, and that's the opening scene. And kind of gripping. It gets your attention right from the go.
Mm. Yeah, the Highland Hospital fire, very very tragic episode in Asheville history, and just so happened that a celebrity, Zelda Fitzgerald, died in that fire. But as you mentioned, 8 other women perished, and I found death certificates for all those women a few years ago and tracked them down to their final resting places. I don't know that the names of all of these women who died in that fire have ever been read out loud since that time. So I'm just going to do a reading of the names of the women who perished in the Highland Hospital fire, the year of birth, year of death, which of course will all be the same, and their final resting place. Janice Rita Borichoff, 1927 to 1948, Rome, Georgia. Marthina DeFries, 1923 to 1948, Bristol, Tennessee. Mildred Ursel Belton Doering, 1903 to 1948, Johnson City, Tennessee. Ida Levy Engel, 1880 to 1948, University City, Missouri. Zelda Sarah Fitzgerald, 1900 to 1948, Rockville, Maryland. Sarah Neely Hipps, 1898 to 1948, Asheville, North Carolina. Virginia Juanita Ward James, 1919 to 1948, Atlanta, Georgia. Ethelyn Averett Kennedy, 1905 to 1948, Kinston, North Carolina. Oma Thompson Womack, 1898 to 1948, Maryville, Tennessee. Yeah.
Good work.
So I think that's important just to know those names and some dates, some of them very young, some of them more mature. Zelda ended up buried in Rockville, Maryland. Is that where her family were from?
Her family was from Montgomery, Alabama. Her dad was a state federal, Supreme Court judges.
Okay.
In Alabama. So she was kind of raised well-to-do. You know, she was a debutante, and she had her, what did they call it? The presentation, how Southern, it used to be, you know,
cotillion?
But when, you know, a girl turned 16, she was like, and now we present Zelda Sayer to the, you know, and, so she was raised well-to-do. And, F. Scott was, he did go to Princeton, but his family had no money. And he was never rich. He wasn't rich like these people he went to college with, like the Firestone family. You know, he didn't have money like them. He had money that, ran out. And, when the paychecks weren't coming in, they didn't have money. And in fact, toward the end of Zelda's life, she waited tables in Asheville. I mean, she was a table busser and waited tables. So,
Yeah. A tragic figure, Zelda Fitzgerald.
One famous person did come out of Highland Hospital, though. The doctor's wife was Nina Simone's piano teacher.
Okay.
So Nina Simone took piano lessons there, too. And she went on to a really fabulous career. As a pianist and a singer.
Interesting. I just saw where her birthplace is. It down in Tryon?
Yeah.
Saw where her birthplace is up for sale. Hopefully somebody who appreciates her history and contribution to music and culture will purchase that and restore it. We're talking about Zelda Fitzgerald and not all pleasant times around Asheville, but things that we might want to take notice of. And remember, this is Joshua P. Warren speaking of strange. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Speaking of Strange. Jimmy Mack coming back. Jim McKenzie going to talk with us a little more about Zelda Fitzgerald. Let's talk about the Christina Ricci portrayal in the new series Z, the beginning of everything on Amazon. Christina Ricci kind of endeared herself to me as a sort of macabre babe. when she actually was just a kid. I don't mean that in a salacious way, but the reboot of the Addams Family, the Casper, the Friendly Ghost movies. I just thought she was great. She was awesome in those roles, and now she's a vavoom, all woman, right? I haven't even seen, other than the trailers and some stills from this movie, but I hear she's pretty fiery. Would you say that's an accurate statement?
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, I almost think she's perfect for this role. Yeah, she's doing a great job, and I know she's working behind the scenes too. Like, she's the one who optioned the book that it's based on, and then is part of the production crew. So she's got her fingers in a lot of things of it, and she's doing a really good job. I mean, she might have two or three more career paths opening up for her. If this is the kind of quality of work she's going to be putting out, like, without a doubt.
So it would seem that she's been fascinated with Zelda for some time before making this series, huh?
I've watched some interviews with her, and she has said the exact same thing that when F. Scott and Zelda met during World War I in 1919, I mean, women couldn't even vote. Like, there was no, like, you could not legally as a female go. So the world was going through that first wave feminism right there. And Zelda was, she was in that too. I mean, she was in the suffragette. So that was a big, big movement, just to see, these guys that are 20 years old and suddenly women can vote. And I mean, that was a huge, huge sea change in America at that time.
And she kind of personifies the whole flapper culture, wouldn't you say?
She did. So one of the most interesting things I have found from Zelda, and I hope I wrote down where it was from, but she wrote this magazine article because, she was kind of famous, and people kind of started noticing that she could write too. So she started getting gigs as a writer. I mean, they would like, write this column. And she wrote this beautiful piece called The Eulogy on the Flapper, where she was, I think, one of the first figureheads of a movement. When I say, like, figureheads, she's well identified as a flapper. But she's one of the first figureheads of a movement that I think in the 20th century that says this movement is over. And it's right as most people are starting to hear about the movement, like when it's finally trickled down to the rest of us through movies and magazines and everything. She was already saying, yeah, this is done. This is all just fashion and haircuts, and people aren't even understanding this anymore. And I kind of thought, like all of the other, 20th century, like, Johnny Rotten, The Clash hasn't even put out their first album yet, and Johnny Rotten's like, punk is over, or the big procession for the hippies in 1968 down Haight-Ashbury, they're saying, like, this is, it's ended. And most people by 68 were just kind of like, what's a hippie? What is this new fangled thing? And people were already declaring it dead. And I think she might be one of the first figureheads of a 20th century pop movement, I guess is what I want to call it, to declare, like, prematurely over, to what most people would say prematurely, other people would say no. And I think that's one of the most fascinating things about her. She saw, like, oh yeah, this has been taken over by people who have no idea what they're even
right doing. By the time the public at large
right
catches on, it's over.
It's done.
It's kind of like her era's disco sucks. Like,
yeah,
the explosion
right
at the baseball stadium. Like, let's burn all the disco records.
Yeah.
But flappers. Flappers are so passe.
But in the 20s, we didn't have 100 years of American pop culture to look back on and kind of, like, that she was groundbreaking. She might have been the first.
Well, there technically would have been 100 years, but we don't, what would have been the things of the 17,
yeah, right.
It would have been the first.
No, okay.
There was not mass communication,
sure,
on the rapid, like, scale that it was.
Wagon
with the
trains
press and
are so last year.
Newsreels and movies. These things were communicating these fashion, these fads. you know, more widely right. and more rapidly than ever before.
And so that's something I've always given her credit for, to have that kind of, you know, awareness of the movement. She was the first, I think, yeah.
Fascinating. I read a clip that I thought was interesting, and I figured we would bring it up on Joshua P. Warren's Speaking of Strange. Be sure to drop by joshuapwarren.com. Is there a period after the P, Shelley?
No.
joshuapwarren.com and see what Josh is up to. He's always got something going on. He's got some coffee now, a Bermuda Triangle coffee.
Really?
Yeah.
I think he should send us some.
Yeah.
You want to try it out?
Yeah. Josh has got a line on some Bermuda Triangle coffee that, I'm anxious to give it a shot. Anyway, he talked about Merkins on the show before. And this article that I was reading about Z, I don't know if you know where I'm going with this, Jim, but they say there's a scene where Zelda appears in the doorway on Deshabillée. No clothing, you know, she's got her jewelry on or whatever, but she's standing in the doorway nude, but she has a large Merkin, and a Merkin is a pubic hair wig. But they were talking about shooting this scene using faux pubic hair, and this is Safe Harbor, folks, so yeah, it may be a little tasteless. I'm just getting you warmed up for Dark 30.
Technically not, but it's not out of line.
After 10 works, though, right?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So, okay.
It's a real thing. It's legitimate.
Okay. This is socially, or at least thematically acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
And there is an interview with Christina Ricci about this outrageously large pubic hair wig that she's wearing in this scene, and she said that I kind of got the idea that they would maybe fix it up in post or something, and so it wouldn't be so outrageous, outlandish. But apparently the wires have picked up on the story of this large Merkin. You've seen the scene, you know.
I did not know that this was, but yes, I know what you're talking about, sure.
Was said Merkin eye-catching? Or?
Well, you know, that's... she's
noteworthy?
It is noteworthy. It is noteworthy.
Okay.
But she was known in Montgomery as being, you know, she was, if anyone was going skinny dipping, she was the first in line. You know, like that's... You know, and these things that were considered very unladylike, like chewing bubble gum, and she was, it's funny to hear how something, we think chewing bubble gum is so passe now, but like in 1919 in Montgomery, Alabama, a female chewing bubble gum was like,
scandalous.
Who do you think you are, young lady? You know.
I came here to do two things, chew some bubble gum.
And wear a Merkin.
And wear a Merkin.
I'm all out of bubblegum. Yeah, Josh brought up the Merkin. It's a fun word for one thing. But Josh brought it up when he came back from London because he had taken the Jack the Ripper tour, and somehow the guide on the Jack the Ripper tour had got into a conversation about Merkins. Because some of the ladies of the evening over there had developed disease or
no
crabs or lice or whatever like that and had lost their natural body hair, so they needed to use these Merkins to ply their trade, you know, so that people wouldn't discover that. Evidently that they were diseased. Or
let's just roll out to commercial here. And,
on that note.
You learn so much on this show.
I have been illuminated.
The things that Joshua P. Warren brought us back from his travels, that's one that stayed with me. By the way, speaking of tours, I don't know if there will be any additional Merkin information, but you should go on the Haunted Asheville tour, hauntedasheville.com, running all winter. Seen some photos from recent tours. Great stuff going on. HauntedAsheville.com. We'll be right back.
what's in your life, dear Stephanie? What's in your life for me? Aches and pains, they cloud your sight.
Welcome back to Speaking of Strange. I'm Vance Pollock, and I'm proud to be an American.
Huh.
We derailed it. I'm an hour early. I'm trying to get myself ready for the Dark 30. You folks know what that's about. It's about unseemly, inappropriate, and very entertaining news items, and we do that the third hour. So, coming up. I did have to comment about Christina Ricci's wardrobe and the fact that she got some press out of an interesting wardrobe accessory, we'll say.
And we may have looked up the
image. We may have done some research.
We did.
You know, during the break.
It was pretty cool.
If Sam approves, I mean, it's... trivia worthy. You didn't know the word merkin.
I didn't.
Wow.
I kept thought you were saying gherkin the entire time.
I thought it was some kind of a like a plant container, like you'd grow, you know, like your thyme in it or parsley.
I had a good friend who was the lead singer and guitarist of a group. I would compare them somewhat to Primus and Zappa. They were avant-garde rock in Central Florida in the early 90s called Fuzz, or Frolicking Ubiquitous Zebras, Fuzz being the acronym. And as lead singer and guitarist of that group, his stage name was Travolta Merkin. And that's pretty clever. So Travolta Merkin, wherever in the world you are, shout out. And go with God. I don't know if that's the appropriate thing. Oh, man. I'm ready for the Dark 30. Let's get back to Zelda. She was definitely cutting edge. She was a liberated woman. She was a strong voice and an outspoken personality. You mentioned that she wrote some columns and articles and things like that. She published books as well, didn't she? Or just one?
She has one book. And it was kind of... her take on her, it's called Save Me the Waltz, and it was her one book, and kind of her and F. Scott wrote, they had a period in their life where they were doing a lot of affairs on each other, and they both had their own takes on it, you know, and it's a really well-received book, and I think a lot of people... have seen that F. Scott really widely plagiarized his wife. A lot of the things that ended up in his books were from her diaries verbatim. And what kind of a genius was he? So here's something I would love to talk about. The idea of the dichotomy of loving someone and then loving them to, like, controlling them, and how love is supposed to be healing, but it's also corrosive, and they had all of those elements in their relationship, that it was, it's, the TV show Z kind of, F. Scott looks tyrannical, and I don't know if he was or not. But he kind of comes across as a, you know, controlling husband type misogynist. You can't do this because I said so. In real life, Zelda, at age 27, rejoined the ballet. She wanted to be a dancer again. And she started studying in France with girls that were like 12 and 13 years old. She was 27. I mean, she's like more than twice. There. I mean, if you're going to be a ballerina, you start young, not at 27. So, but she was doing okay, and she got a part in a Spanish ballet, I think. And F. Scott said, after all this work, after all this time, a year or two of her working daily on this, he said, no, you're not going to do it. You're not joining. And I think she did the only reasonable thing of any woman could do. She grabbed the steering wheel from his hands and tried to steer them off a cliff.
And luckily, the vehicle would only go 6 miles per hour. Yeah. So
he had plenty of time to stop it. Well, this would have been in 1930-ish. So,
okay. Yeah.
You know, they were probably cruising at a 25-mile-per-hour clip, you know.
Yeah.
So, but
to hurt.
To me, that seems like, yeah, that's reasonable after all that. And F. Scott just forbids her. And he would have said, it's because I love you and I need you and I need you here. And so they had this relationship that was totally loving and completely unhealthy. And I don't know if they, now we have these talk shows on TV, you know, we can see like, oh yes, that's, these people are, but back then I don't know if they were able to recognize how toxic their affair was. Yeah.
Fascinating relationship.
Yeah, totally.
Tragic, finally. You need to tell us a little bit about Zelda Fitzgerald Day. Of course, there's a historical marker for Zelda out near UNCA campus there, which is close to the Highland Hospital property. But Zelda Fitzgerald Day in Asheville happened last year, didn't it?
Is there a second annual? It's a little idea I had. We petitioned the city to read a proclamation and declare March 10th Zelda Fitzgerald Day in Asheville. Now, March 10th is the day she actually died in Asheville. It's a little morbid, but it's a day that Asheville can claim. And we've spent decades not recognizing this woman, like kind of like how we were talking about earlier, Vance, how history has just kind of painted her as a kind of, you know, like a one-trick pony party girl. And I think that's part of the idea behind Zelda Fitzgerald Day, kind of showing the world she was not just that. She was multidimensional, very complex. So, yeah, this year happened again, second annual Zelda Day. We have even more fun. We're going to show some of her paintings at the Asheville Art Museum on the slope. They're rebuilding the new art museum right now. So, you know what I'm saying? Like downtown in Pack Square, they're redoing it. So the it's moved. It's called the Asheville Art Museum on the slope now. They're kind of doing it. So we're going to show some of her paintings there, have some readings of hers across town, like at Malaprops, at Firestorm Bookstore. And just do some fun things, and I hope to get it a little bigger every year. We've definitely grown from last year. I want it to grow a little more every year. I hope there's a 3 and a 4 and a 5 and a 10. Because she had a really deep connection to Asheville, and for decades we have yeah, you're right. There's a marker in town that says Zelda died here. And that's it. We don't have any days, anything celebrating her, I kind of wanted to change that, and I'm hoping that this day is going to start putting her name out in front of more people, at least in our city of Asheville. And it's funny, the more people I talk to about it, the more they had no idea that Zelda ever lived here. They have no idea that Zelda died here in Asheville. They had no clue that she had such connections to this city. No idea.
I think it's interesting that that era is sort of coming back into vogue. You noticed in recent years, girls have started wearing the bob haircuts again.
Yeah.
And, the fashion is attractive. To me, it's just gorgeous. I love to look at the photographs, magazines from the 20s. It was just amazing. Quite a fabulous time. When did the breakdown come? What was it that brought her to Highland Hospital?
Yeah, so one of the mysteries of her life, besides the fire at Highland, one of the mysteries of her life is she was diagnosed schizophrenic. And I have read a lot of post modern day doctor analysis of Zelda, and there is evidence that she did hear voices. Also, there's a lot of evidence that a lot of doctors say she was just manic depressive. That today, if she were alive today, she would be on some type of medication and would continue her life as normal. So her breakdown started right in her late 20s, I think, and that's kind of in line with what I think how schizophrenia works. In your 20s, you don't really experience it in your teens. So into your 20s, you start. But then again, I've read a lot of doctors who do not think she was mentally ill, who think she was just manic depressive. And I think that's kind of the angle that this show Z is taking. There's like one, it's not a spoiler, but there's this one scene where she's driving their little motor car and F. Scott's like, well, I don't have any money for the toll. And she's like, well, let's just, you know, she just rams right through the little arm. And then she's laughing and laughing and laughing and just having a great time. And then she runs into a deer and the deer's dying and she gets out and she's just inconsolably weeping. And I kind of think that that's my amateur understanding of what manic depressiveness is, like a really manic high, like crazy, fun, gay, and then a really desperate low. And I think that the show, who's ever producing it and writing her character, is playing that into the character. So that was kind of brilliant. Yeah, kind of genius.
Interesting. Well, we've enjoyed learning a little bit about Zelda Fitzgerald. Jim McKenzie, our guest here on Joshua P. Warren Speaking of Strange. We'll wrap up the second feature hour after this break. Stay with us. Welcome back to Joshua P. Warren Speaking of Strange. I'm Vance Pollock in the studio with investigator Shelley Wright, producer Sam the Animal Steel, and Jim McKenzie, Jimmy Mack, as I sometimes like to call him. We've learned a little something about Zelda today. Did you learn a little something about Zelda,
yes,
Shelley?
Yes, I did.
Sound like your kind of gal? Except for the going crazy and burning up a hospital fire.
Yeah, except for that part. Yeah.
What do you think? Do you, when you were hearing him talk about some of the diagnosis, the thought that maybe she was hearing voices and things like that, and that she died tragically around there. Do you think that Zelda may have left some psychic residue around Asheville?
Probably so. Probably.
She might be somebody we could try to communicate with.
I'd have left a merkin around here.
I thought we'd gotten past that roadblock. Oh, goodness.
You saw the size of it. It was literally a roadblock.
It would be a speed bump, at least. Oh, my Lord. What have we done? I think I got time. This is the short segment, end of the hour. I got time to read a little something I wrote about another Asheville Wild woman. You heard of the Duke? Well, you will hear of the Duke. Josh loves his Duke.
Yes, I do know the Duke. Yes, I do.
The Duke, local moniker of the man known variously as Charles Asquith, Lord Walter Beresford, and genuinely Sidney Lascelles, came to Asheville and died in October 1904. Within days, it's discovered that he had arrived here under a fictitious name, and for months, his true identity is unknown. During the time that he remained unidentified, there was speculation. Naturally, people wondered if he were any of several well-known imposters, con men, and bigamists still at large. One guess was that he had been the phony Lord Reginald Oswald Douglas or Lord Percy Sholto Douglas, both aliases of John Cavendish, a man of about the same age who had left a trail of robbed and abandoned wives from Virginia to Mexico. Cavendish was the name used by this gentleman when he presumably arrived in Asheville early in the fall of 1905. His likely but as yet undocumented arrival might temptingly be pinned on curiosity. He had recently returned from California, where he had abandoned a pregnant wife, the former Miss Louisiana Hobbs of Norfolk, Virginia. Miss Hobbs' family gave publicity to the thought that our Duke may have been the same Lord Douglas, but upon further investigation abandoned the idea. The sensational press of the day had already latched onto the story, and it was reported widely with varying details for the next few years. In fact, even after the Duke had been claimed and removed from Asheville in 1910, some newspapers continued to publish a mugshot of the bogus Lord Douglas as a life portrait of the now infamous Asheville mummy. Back to Asheville in the fall of 1905, we can easily imagine the debonair and deceitful Lord Douglas, a.k.a. John Cavendish, far from dead, dropping by the Nolan Brown Undertaking Parlor on Church Street for a darkly humorous look at his own corpse. What is known is that by the December of that year, he had wooed and married a young Josephine Hood of Asheville. Josephine's parents were from an old and proud Buncombe County family, her grandparents being of the wealthy Alexander, Roberts, and Ray clans, now moldering in the dust of Newton Academy Cemetery alongside the likes of the Pattons and the Smiths. As is usual in such cases, we imagine her father being quite suspect of this whirlwind romance and whisking away of his teenage daughter by the much older and charismatic noble Englishman. All the same, the couple were married at New Iberia, Louisiana, where Mr. Hood was then residing on business and departed on their honeymoon from New Orleans and would mix business with pleasure while visiting Mexico, where Cavendish said he owned oil wells. "Don't be surprised," he told her family, "if you don't hear from us for a month or two." A month or two of silence turned to several, and a check with the American consul in Mexico revealed that mail addressed to the couple there was piling up unclaimed. Belle Hood, the missing bride's mother, sounded the alarm amongst Asheville nobility, and by June 1906 the story was spreading like wildfire in the national press. Handsome rewards were raised by friends and family of the missing girl. The North Carolina governor posted an additional reward for the apprehension of the notorious bigamist Cavendish, known to be the same man who had posed as Lord Douglas and a handful of other aliases, married by best count to 8 other women in recent years. Josephine's mother was in a panic. Suspicion was aired that young Miss Cavendish had been murdered and was buried somewhere in the Mexican desert. Then, in early March 1905, headlines began to appear with the likes of "Girl's Wounded Pride Makes Her an Exile." Finally, it becomes clear that Miss Cavendish is playing these games along with her shyster husband. In a sprawling cemetery in Houston is the grave of the poet Hamilton O'Malley. Though this was the name carved on the tombstone, this was John Cavendish. He was the famed poet of Houston, the notorious Lord Douglas, also known as John Cavendish. But though he was once the most sought-after scoundrel in America, he met his match when he married a not-quite-so-innocent mountain girl, Josephine Hood.
Can I just say that bigamy seems like one of the worst, stupidest kinds? It's like bad enough to be married to one person.
Why a man would marry once is a mystery. Why he would marry twice is a bigamistry.